Hello, Soft Spot listeners, which there seem to be more and more of you, which is really exciting. And thank you once again for joining us. Sorry for the brief hiatus. We've been pretty busy here ramping up to our next big event, the Global Soft Symposium in Belgium. If you don't know, we put on a conference in Europe every year. We've done Lithuania, Romania, Spain, and now for round number 4, we'll be in Brussels, Belgium. It's going to be a great opportunity to engage with European government and industry, and it's happening from October 1st through the 3rd. So it's coming up really quick, but there's definitely still time to get on board. So head on over to globalsoftsymposium.org to get caught up after you listen to this episode, of course. This is actually part one of a 2-part episode, and it's the first time we've done that. So Stu, which if you don't know, Stu Braden is the Global Soft Foundation's president and CEO, and he was also in the U.S. Army Special Forces for 32 years. And I guess I should say that I'm Chelsea Hamishin, the GSF's Director of Marketing. So anyways, Stu and I headed to Orlando last week to meet with our good friend Dan Irizarry. Dan is a really cool guy and also a really smart guy. He has done a ton to transform soft medicine, including standing up the medic training program at the NATO soft headquarters, which of course is awesome. So we talked for a really long time. And because of that, I was able to divide it into 2 episodes. This episode is really focused on medic training through simulation, advancements in tactical combat casualty care, aka TC3, the difference between medics and conventional forces versus SOF, and we say the word tourniquet a lot. So here I am with Dan Irizarry and Stu, recording from Dan's doctor's office in Orlando, Florida.
And then if we want to break it down.
Wow. Global Soft Foundation.
My immediate reaction was, this is awesome.
This idea.
The Special Operations Association
for Special Operations. You have our support. Let's move.
Welcome to Soft Spot.
I started off, I'm a board-certified family physician. Started off my career at the Uniformed Services University of the Health Sciences, where I got my degree in medicine. And then went to Fort Bragg, North Carolina for a family medicine residency. Volunteered for the 82nd Airborne Division. Went to the initial invasion in Iraq with the Falcons, 325th Airborne Infantry Regiment. And then pretty much PCS'd from Baghdad to Afghanistan when I joined 3rd Battalion, 3rd Special Forces Group. I was a battalion surgeon for 3rd Special Forces Group for a few years, and then did some work in Germany as a medical director and commander of a clinic. And then I had the great opportunity to come to Belgium, where I was the first physician for the NATO Special Operations Headquarters, where I met Stu. Stu gave me one simple mission: fix NATO.
Oh,
he was a little more colorful in the way he said that.
A little bit more profanity.
What? Can't
but
believe
he told me to fix NATO medicine. And and I couldn't travel. That was the second thing he told me.
I said boondoggle.
No boondoggle.
So
we
had a great opportunity to build a training center for special operations medicine that built medical systems and helped nations build their medical systems to support special operations forces. That center still runs today. It's called the Allied Center for Medical Education. And it was heavily based on simulation because, frankly, in the absence of combat, you don't have casualties. And so you have to simulate them somehow, way, shape, or form. So we created this simulation capability. When I finished the job there, the Department of Defense was centralizing how simulation for medicine was acquired and how it was advanced developed here in Orlando, Florida. So they asked me to come to Orlando, Florida, help be the leader of an office that would centralize the acquisition and advanced development of medical simulation. Not only combat medical simulation, but hospital-based simulation. And so for the last 4 years, before I retired last year, I was the clinical advisor to the DOD's Office for Medical Simulation.
And they made you a colonel.
Yeah, well,
which is good.
They'll make anyone a colonel these days.
I know, trust me. They do that.
Anyone in this room.
Exactly.
Well, backing up a little bit, talking about the medical simulation, how have you seen that kind of progress over the years?
Yeah, pre-9/11, What was the whole environment like? I mean, I remember it was kind of like, hey, cross training was a joke, you know, stop the bleeding, open the airway. You know, it was very benign. You know what I mean? We didn't have any casualties. So it was all notional.
Yeah, it was either notional or you train on your buddy.
Yeah, right? The moulage kits were horrible,
which was never realistic.
Yeah, no,
and didn't really put the stress into the process. And then it was always, you know, training was always in medicine was kind of the last thing you did if you had time. Hip pocket training, not, you know, check off all the things you need to do. It wasn't integrated into combat operations.
No, it was permissive environment, man. It's like no one's shooting at you. Right. Everything's calm.
So it was kind of one
Take
of those
your time.
Things that we need. And we spent a lot of time pre 9/11. Really, it wasn't until the 90s that we and Mogadishu that we really started looking at this issue of integrating healthcare on the battlefield into tactical operations. As we progressed through the 90s, the special operations community started looking at tactical combat casualty care, which was blending the care of casualties into the fight in a casualty response, as opposed to kind of an afterthought. Just like taking down a building or CQB, you know, there are individual tasks and there are combined tasks that have to happen simultaneously to have an effect and outcome that you're looking for. In tactical combat casualty care, it's a team sport. You have to have individual tasks to care for the casualty at the right time, at the right place to have them survive. And then you have to have the team continue that process of care even as they're fighting the battle. And that was not a skill that was well understood in the 90s until TC3 started to develop. And then, but in the greater, larger force outside of special operations, it was really not a skill understood because they weren't at war. They weren't in casualties. We weren't doing missions where people actually got hurt. When the war came, that made a big difference. By that time, the concepts of TC3 had been established, but not really gotten into our conventional forces very effectively. But when the war happened in 2003, things got real when people started dying of bleeding to death in the conventional forces. In fact, the conventional forces had a much higher rate of death than the special operations forces throughout the war, but in particular the first 3 to 5 years of the war. It wasn't until 2006 when really tourniquets effectively got to every soldier that you actually saw a significant decrease in combat death. Preventable combat death. All of that was directly related to a couple of things. One was that we had real casualties, so it got real. People said, "Wow, I could actually die. I need to know how to use these tourniquets." Two, industry picked up the ball of actually creating tourniquets that had never been created before because
just the old surgical rubber thing,
right?
The belts, and
right? Well, the tourniquets that we were issuing in the 90s were the same tourniquets we issued in the World War One, actually.
Wow.
Yeah. So nothing had changed in medicine, and we were using
mess with progress.
That's right. We were using morphine serrets, things like that. So just the initiation of the right kit and equipment and getting that tourniquet into the hands of soldiers made a huge difference in survivability. A lot of changes also happened, post 9/11. We started actually studying, because we could, we studied real time how people were dying on the battlefield. Prior to that, we had looked at the data from Vietnam. We knew that there were three preventable causes of combat death. One was bleeding to death from an extremity wound. The second was having an airway obstruction. Because a person becomes unconscious, their tongue falls back. And so you can fix that by putting a tube in someone's nose to help them breathe. And then a problem called a tension pneumothorax, where air gets caught in the chest after an injury and you have to put a needle in the chest to take that, or a chest tube could be used. As to simulation, in the 90s, there was really only one or two companies that made simulators, a human patient simulator. Mm-hmm. There was no VR or AR simulation. It just didn't exist.
So and more like a dummy kind of thing?
Yeah, right.
A mannequin.
Right. Call it. That's a smart dummy.
Yeah, the only dummies that you had were either the guy next to you, right?
Yeah.
Or you had something like a Rescue Randy that gave you no objective feedback that you were doing anything.
Came in a little plastic case. It was always
Yeah.
buried somewhere in the supply room.
Right, and you just pulled it out and you threw a bad tourniquet on it and called it a day and said you were ready.
Could you see the difference in the regiments in Iraq?
We haven't looked at officially the death rates associated with particular forces, but my gut is that forces who were A, had tourniquets, and B, were well trained on how to use them probably had better survival. But we know for sure that if you looked at probably the quintessential leader for tactical combat casualty care integration was General McChrystal, because when he was a lieutenant colonel running the Rangers, as a colonel, he made the Rangers integrate tactical combat casualty care or casualty response into everything they did.
Yeah.
And another person who is one of his physicians or the lead physician, a guy named Colonel Russ Cotwall, and his NCO, a guy named Monty Montgomery, that combination of a leader that is a line commander with a physician who has the clinical skills and abilities to make the right clinical decisions, and an NCO who can actually execute those processes and do the training, was a very powerful combination. So you having the leadership command and then the right people to force the process was very critical. And the data shows that in preventable combat death amongst the Rangers, there was zero preventable combat death in the Rangers from 2001 to 2011, which is the data that we really looked at, compared to the conventional force, which had about a 16% death rate. So
that's because they made it a command priority.
They said
it's not the doc's responsibility. Yeah. It's a leadership responsibility. You own it. It's yours.
In fact, the Rangers did a very important thing that every military organization really needs to do. And they changed the name of medical care on the battlefield to the Commander's Casualty Response System. They changed the whole vernacular. If you look in the Ranger doctrine now, they don't talk about medical care or treatment. They talk about the Commander's Casualty Response System, because the Commander's Casualty Response System is actually multifaceted. One piece of it is medically what's happening, but another piece of it is the security that's being provided. Another piece of that is the fight that's ongoing. And how do you balance the fight with the security, with the care and the draw on logistical resources that's having, and make those tactical decisions when to fight more and when you can care for your casualties? All of those are command decisions. Those aren't really medical decisions. And most people don't really know how to do that well because they don't practice it as an integrated approach.
You know, one of the things that I don't think people understand is, a lot of people say, hey, the conventional force should be doing a lot more of what the special operations forces are doing. And the answer to that is you're correct. The biggest problem you find it in the conventional force is that if they deploy a force to pick northern Niger in the middle of the Sahara Desert, they don't have the organic medical resources inside a small infantry footprint to do that. So in order for them to deploy that force, they have to send an augmented medical package. And what I was explaining to Chelsea earlier is the medevac bubble. Talk a little bit about the medevac bubble, how it restricts operations, and how organizations that have greater medical training, like the special operations, the Rangers and those folks, they get greater latitude operationally because they have the medical care that allows them to go outside the medical evac bubble. Right. Can you talk to that a little bit?
Yeah. So in Afghanistan, it was very interesting. In Afghanistan, at the height of the war, probably between 2006 and about 2012, when we started really drawing down, you had basically the best evacuation system in the world for trauma, better than probably just about anywhere in the United States. You would get to a trauma surgeon's surgical hands within 60 minutes, no matter where you were in Afghanistan, because of the sheer amount of helicopters and their range of helicopters. And commanders were actually prevented from doing missions unless they could get into that get to that 60-minute bubble. In fact, at the time, the Secretary of Defense, Gates, mandated that you could not do operations but for you were within 60 minutes. And the data shows that he saved probably about 350 lives by mandating that requirement. But the reality is that those you can't provide, unless you're going to spend 10 years building a trauma system everywhere you go, that's not a sustainable solution. We know very well that a force-on-force situation with a near peer is not going to be anything like what we're fighting now. So when you look at those bubbles and you look at the situations, for sure, it's nice to have, but it's just not realistic for the future. And so how do you mitigate that? Well, you mitigate that by, one, providing the right equipment to the to every soldier or as many soldiers as you can. Make that equipment simple enough to use so that everyone can use it. Give them appropriate training in the process so that they know how to use it, and commanders direct that they're going to use that equipment, and then practice it in an objective manner and really test it on an objective manner, which is where these mannequins really come into the process, because there really is no difference between shooting your weapon and putting a tourniquet on a casualty. You have to know the right target that you want to hit. You have to have the basic skills to operate the equipment, and then you have to decide, you have to have command directive when you're going to fire the weapon, and you have to be able to be trusted that you can fire the weapon. You have to have some objective measurement that says that you're able to sight that weapon. The difference is that today we are just now getting the technologies of high fidelity mannequins to the soldiers' hands so that the commander can really see, yep, you are an expert marksman. You are expert capability of functioning effectively in the commander's casualty response system.
Because it gives you like the vital signs. It has blood flow inside of them.
Yeah.
That's equivalent to a normal human being. And if you don't hit the tourniquet right, the thing still bleeds. If you don't find all the holes, you know what I mean? If you're not high enough up. Or,
yeah,
we go to ITSEC every year, and the things that they have there are like so lifelike.
Right, and it's scary. And it dies, really. You know, just like the same thing. If you want precision casualty response, you need to practice over and over and over again the simple tasks, the basic tasks of identifying what you're going to die from first, putting on those tourniquets very quickly or addressing those issues, and most importantly, communicating the situation to the command so the command can allocate resources. And that's where we really fail. We think that this medical thing is just a medical thing, but it's not. It's it's part of the combat operations. And in the absence of speed and practice, what actually happens is it slows combat operations. And what people think is, oh, well, we'll just deal with the medical stuff, or we'll tell them not to deal with the casualties until the end of the operation. But none of that ever works, because when your buddy gets shot and he's yelling your name for help, you don't just ignore him. It's a pipe dream to think you are. People just don't do that. But if you know the right things to do, then you can tell him what to do, and he's secure and he feels comfortable, you can move on with the mission. Or if you've all practiced it really well, then it's not a problem.
With the increase in training tools, are you seeing that there are a lot more medics in SOF, like more people trained, at least with the basic
training? So really it's not about training the medics in SOF. Mm-hmm. It's about training everyone. Mm-hmm. And in our conventional forces.
What's the you said you gave me a percentage earlier of the person that wounded on the battlefield has like 87% of them are cared for by their buddy?
Yeah. I mean, the most likely person that's going to treat a casualty, you know, is going to be this guy next to you, either yourself or the guy next to you. I mean, you look at a U.S. Special Operations team that has 12 people on it. Two of them happen to be medics. Sometimes you don't have both your medics for various reasons.
So you got
a 1 in 11 chance of having the medic next to you. And if he's not the guy that's injured, right? I've had a number of medics that were the casualties. It's even less common that you're going to be with a medic in a conventional force. So really, you have to train those folks to a much higher level and standard. And to ensure that they are capable of doing what they need to do, you want to give them an experience. You either want to give them lots of sets and reps and sets, or you want to give them a very, very memorable experience. And so that very memorable experience is one of the reasons that people think so highly of live tissue training. It gets very realistic. You never forget it. It's the casualty lives or dies based upon how you treat that casualty, and you can't outfox the physiology. And those mannequins are censored in such a way that I know exactly when you put the tourniquet on. I know exactly how much blood the casualty lost. I know what you touched, where you touched it, and when you touched it. And I can come back to a commander and say that casualty would have survived. But the other thing is, it's so realistic for the person using the mannequins, they never forget touching those mannequins. I've worked with very, I won't call names, but I've made some very senior 4-stars sweat when they had to put a tourniquet on a mannequin, failed with the first tourniquet, the mannequin kept bleeding, and they had to put a second tourniquet on the casualty to make that bleeding stop. And once that bleeding stopped, they finally started realizing how hard that is, which is one of the reasons the Army spent $20 million investing in these mannequins.
It's about a tenth of what they probably should have spent.
It's only a small amount.
Yeah,
but it's a drop in the bucket, actually, when you look at the DOD's budget. But the opportunity for every soldier to have an experience that gives them confidence and ability, and the commander, the information that tells you that, yes, these guys can actually do what they need to do, it's a start.
Let's take a quick break to talk about a GSF corporate partner, AC4S. They're a small business partner that is near and dear personally to my heart because I've actually known the founder, Norm Abdallah, since I was a teenager. He used to work with my dad back in Okinawa, and now I get to work with him, which is pretty cool. AC4S delivers a wide variety of services and solutions globally to special operations, intelligence, and diplomacy with C5ISR, mission support, and professional services. AC4S is providing innovative solutions, transformational communications, and critical operational support in multi-agency and coalition environments, including deployed tactical forces. AC4S has supported SOF from the U.S. SOCOM headquarters to the components, the TSOCs, and several JSOTFs. AC4S provides support services in 18 different states and 12 countries, mostly in non-permissive environments. Thanks, AC4S. Let's get back to the episode.
So let's shift gears to you forming the training center at the NATO SOFT headquarters. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, my guidance to you was fix it because it didn't exist. I mean, there was really nothing to fix. You were starting with nothing and working your way from zero. And you started at a very interesting spot. I thought you were going to go out there and do what most people do, is just start training medics, right? Because to me, that's what doctors do. And you didn't do that at all. You lifted your gun sights and went strategically, and you went after surgeon generals. Just kind of walk us through your whole process.
So, you know, we had a great team over the course of time that brought all that into fruition. And again, it started off with command emphasis. You know, having you and having General Kisner give the resources to be able to move forward was critical. The interesting thing about NATO special operations at that time was...
What year was it, for reference?
This was 2010 when I first got there. Mm-hmm. I left in 2014. And the center opened in 2012. So in some countries, like in the United States, some things that a soldier first responder can do, only a physician can do in some countries. Highly variable what medical authorities you give people on the battlefield. When you're dealing with NATO, you're really dealing with mainly a conventional force. The special operations forces in NATO are variable in size, and they're kind of hidden away in this much, much larger conventional piece. So we had to somehow come up with a way that, A, we could reach out to these folks and then create a community of like-minded people. And then we would have to work with their senior leaders, both their line leadership and their medical leadership, which were typically physicians, to give the authorities so that these special operations medical systems would be able to grow and thrive. And the only way to be able to do that was through training. And so NSHQ had a good training program for kind of soft systems already, but it didn't have anything for soft medical systems. And soft medical systems meant, what is the soldier capable of doing? What is the medic capable of doing? And what is the physician in that soft medical capable of doing? And how does the commander use that soft medical system to support his operations?
I remember that was really important because In 2010, we were surging into Afghanistan, and General McChrystal was, you know, we went from 345 special ops, NATO special ops, to over 2,600, and we lacked ISR, aviation, and medical.
Right.
Like, we had all these great warriors, but they couldn't go outside the medevac bubble because they didn't have the organic things it needed to do that. And that's kind of was the big, I mean, that's why General Kizer and was able to just, you know, tell me, write whatever check needs to be written and fix this problem.
But in the, I mean, it was well worth the investment in terms of lives saved. And now it continues to pay dividends. But when you look at this in that situation of soft medical systems, we had to first identify the community. So we identified who were the people that they were either believed they were in charge or were in charge of the soft medical system in their country. And we started bringing in conventional and soft medical leaders into this to establish a knowledge base for soft medical systems within the country.
So how long did that take?
About a year.
Yeah, it wasn't, it's not, because
I mean,
there's a lot of people.
I thought that would have taken forever.
A lot of people weren't what you thought they were.
Right. Well, you know what I mean? Everyone brought to the game what they could,
yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
And so in that first year, we were able to do that. We also, it was the first year we purchased a top-of-the-line combat trauma mannequin at the time. And we started to show, yeah.
Wow.
Just to play with, well, yeah, wasn't, the DOD couldn't even buy them.
Yeah.
That's all I remember is, I said, well, we will.
Yeah, we bought it and remember at the time we had our own soldiers, NSHQ soldiers forward deployed. Mm. So one of my things was I was not going to have our forward deployed soldiers, should they find themselves in a bad situation, not be able to survive because we didn't properly train them.
Yeah, so, we all went through a medical training, had our own med gear with us. Right. I mean,
and so then we had
to create that. That didn't exist.
Yeah, right. We created a combat trauma training system for our own people. We used the mannequins to train with. And that was another piece of it. And also to explain to senior leaders, we would show senior leaders what real trauma looked like that they'd never seen and how you could treat it on these mannequins. The second piece that we had to do was because of the different rules and laws within the nations, we didn't really have the ability to just say, oh, send me all your doctors or send me all your medics or send me what have you. They had to figure out how they were going to treat with what they had. And so that's why we built the simulation center. See, the simulation center, you didn't have to solve the problem the same way as another country, but the problem had to be solved. And so the nations would come and they would do this simulation and they would see their glaring gaps. We didn't have to show them their glaring gaps.
Jumps off the page.
It would obviously be to them where they...
Panic and dies.
Yeah. It would be very obvious to them where they were struggling. So we created a surgical special operations team course for those nations. And now about 8 nations have functional special operations surgical teams that support their soft units. But more than that, the knowledge base was growing for other surgeons to be able to do it in other countries. What we did was we had these series of research workshops where we brought the nations together to write NATO soft medicine doctrine. And in 2012, we said, well, what would a NATO special operations medic look like? And what tasks would you want them to do? Well, when we went through that process, the leadership at this conference, or when the conference was a research workshop, because the word conference was forbidden.
Mm-hmm. Boondoggle.
That's right. We went to this research workshop.
I told you, man, words matter.
That's right.
I said, where people will go all day to a workshop, but the conference, that's debatable.
The research workshop, we brought in some experts from the United States. We led this thing, and they came up with 65 tasks. Those 65 tasks was what the nations that were there decided would be a reasonable NATO special operations combat medic.
What types of tasks were they?
Some of them were basic tasks, basic first aid. Some of it was diagnostics. Some of it was being able to do a needle decompression. Some of it was a lot of different tasks that were higher level than what most medics would be allowed to do in most European nations. So the NATO Special Operations Combat Medic 65 tasks were created.
Did you guys make that a STANAG? I can't remember.
It's becoming one now.
It's a standard operating procedure for NATO, and that means all the nations agree that you will achieve that standard, and that becomes the norm. So I mean, you show up at the party with those capabilities.
So the Nordic Initiative took off. What they did was they took the 65 tasks and using a system called Nordefco, which was the agreement between the Scandinavians, Denmark, Finland, Norway, and Sweden. The leaders of special operations medicine in the Scandinavian nations put together a course that was 22 weeks and taught all of the tasks, and they shared the responsibility of the course. So a person would spend a certain amount of time in Norway, a certain amount of time in Sweden, a certain amount of time in Finland, and a certain amount of time in Denmark.
Was that only for the Scandinavians?
It was only for the Scandinavians, right? And so they ran the course.
Gotcha.
Right? They ran the first courses. We called it the Nordic Initiative, and they were the first NATO Special Operations Combat Medics. In fact, I signed their certificates as the NATO soft surgeon, saying they were NATO Special Operations Combat Medics. Well, now, as you push down further down the road, course, the Nordics took that course to ISTC in Pfullendorf, and now Pfullendorf is teaching that course.
Do you have any idea, like ballpark, how many were trained in that time?
I don't know the official numbers right now.
We'll go with 7,000.
It's a lot.
No, not 7,000. No. I mean, when you look at the total NATO force, it's
Dan, one of the things inside hundreds. The simulation center, which was interesting, is, you know, there was everybody went through it. You know, I went back there after I'd gone back to SOCOM and worked, and I, because I wanted to see what I wrote that big check for. But I was very, very impressed. But I noticed one of the, it was broken up into quads, I guess, and then one of them was the C-17.
Yeah.
And when most people walked into that room and it looked like the inside of a C-17, people look around going, what is this? Explain to everybody why that's important, because we were losing a lot of people in that transition phase, correct? Yeah. Is that what it was?
Well, you know, there's three times at which a person is likely to die in combat trauma. The very first chance you have to die is the immediate moment of injury. The next time they have the chance to die is in the first 10 minutes, for the most part. And in that first 10 minutes is when your first responders, whoever's right next to you, is going to make the difference. If you can stabilize a person for that first 10 minutes and they haven't lost too much blood, you can keep them alive. But if they're bleeding internally or you can't control their bleeding externally, the only way to save them is to get them to a surgeon. The importance of being able to do surgical skills was critical. You could do surgery anywhere, but in special operations, it was not uncommon to have a surgical capability on an aircraft. And you certainly transported casualties in aircraft. And the aircraft environment is a really challenging place to care for people. And that's another time where people can die, is in that long transport. For us, it was all the way back to Germany. And so we had specialized teams called CCAT teams. So the reason we created an aircraft type of environment was, one, they could feel the confined space of an aircraft. They could practice operating in those loud noise environments. And they realized what the skills and abilities they could do. And they got used to thinking about what they could carry on an aircraft and this kit and equipment. And so one of the great things about the Special Operations Surgical Team course was the ability of nations to see how other nations were doing damage control surgery, and seeing one nation that would bring 15 people on a team and another patient that would bring four. And they'd say, you can do this with four? Oh, yes. And here's how.
So since the beginning, in 2010, when you were talking about the differences between every country, have you seen a little more equalization between the skills of all our partner nations?
For sure. Well, I think several things have happened. At the strategic level, the surgeon generals of the conventional forces have recognized the value of a special operations medical capability and a special operations medical system. We've seen growth in leadership at the kind of the physician level of the operational physician who manages that soft medical system. And we've seen a standardization in the NATO SOCOM at the tactical level to make sure that those people are properly trained in that process. And we've seen the growth in use of simulators, more effectively to test and evaluate what the skills of those people. And as our simulators become more and more durable and effective, that'll only get better. And especially, really, the issue of simulation using virtual reality and augmented reality, that's going to really make skills, at least the cognitive knowledge, the head knowledge that you need to do good medicine on the battlefield and integrate it with combat, will be easier to get through a virtual world. You're still going to have to put a tourniquet on something to get that realistic haptic or hands-on feel. But with virtual reality and augmented reality, we'll be able to do a lot of distributed training to get people trained up to a high level of sets and reps before they actually have to get into the most expensive part of training in any training, which is live training.
Your medical posture also has a lot to do with the decisions, the go, no-go criteria. You know, I mean, it's risk to force. And, you know, politicians will not stay in office if they're getting large numbers of military people wiped out. It just doesn't, you'll be out of office before you can blink, especially a lot of the Eastern European countries that are of these small, fragile coalition governments. If you sneeze on them, they'll shatter. And so they can't afford, I mean, they lose one person. It's a huge deal. And you lose multiple people, it would be catastrophic to them. And so by elevating their medical posture and their, you know, their medical capabilities, you reduce the political risk, and you actually make it easier for people to approve the execution of special operations.
Yeah.
And so that's changed. I mean, because I'm seeing folks do stuff now that, man, 10, 15 years ago, they've never approved. They're like, nah, not today. We'll just wait.
And that's in the support of kinetic operations.
Yeah.
But when you're looking at mission assistance and military assistance missions, there is nothing, politically, the ability to teach other people medical skills and abilities is a very powerful force in the world. You know,
especially in Africa or
right.
South America.
So just the ability to go out and teach people the basics of healthcare is a very valuable thing. And if you don't have that inherent knowledge in your own force, it's very hard to share it.
So that might have felt like a slightly abrupt ending, but like I said at the beginning, we've divided this into two episodes. Check back in next week for the rest of the conversation, which really focuses on the future of soft medicine. Talk to you then.
Soft Spot is brought to you by the Global Soft Foundation, a 501c3 based in Tampa, Florida. If you're new to us, you can find out more about the foundation at gsoft.org. That's Gulf Sierra October Foxtrot.org.